This is a podcast for Monday, February 27th, 2012, Theories of Knowledge. Okay, so announcements on, let's see, there'll be a curve for the midterm, but I haven't determined what that is yet. Later on, let me see, like by tomorrow morning, if you took grades, you'll see what your adjusted score is. You know, it probably won't be any more than 5 or 7 points. Might be 3. But I'll go look at it to see what the scores look like. Let's see, what else? Today we're going to continue with belief and will because we didn't finish that last week. So we'll talk about Pascal's wager, which is in the William James article, and then we'll move on to talking about how much control you have over your beliefs. And then on to Kierkegaard. And then I think we have religious knowledge is next week. No, we had moral. I think I was doing moral knowledge next week, actually. Let me look at my schedule. This schedule is kind of weird because this term there's it like started at a weird time. So all all these 3-day weekends are at weird times. So it's like a week off of what I usually do because I wear a New Year's spell. All right.
Let's see if I have any pens. That was Monday.
Schedule real quick here.
So, have you done any research on that specific date?
The 2012 thing?
Yeah.
Yeah, it seems that the Mayan calendar just sort of ran out of room. It's, you know, you start at the middle and you kind of go around and to the outside and you get to the outside and then you run out of room. And that's sort of the way the calendar works.
If I'm not mistaken, isn't that just the end of an age?
Yeah, so it's, you know, supposed to be these big epochs. But, you know, there's all sorts of people saying, oh, there's the prediction of the end of the world and yada, yada. I haven't looked at any particular, like at the actual Mayan teachings on the subject, just what people have been saying about it. Mm-hmm. I know I hear commonly people trumping this as the end of the world. Whether that's what the Mayans said or not, I don't know that there's any evidence that the Mayans were predicting the end of the world or any cataclysmic or cosmic events to happen at all. It's just, but I haven't made an in-depth study of the matter.
If I'm not mistaken, like, it's not that it's the end of the world so much as it's an end of an age, like, meaning like the 20th century ended and the 21st century started. Mm-hmm. Similar kind of concept, but supposedly it's supposed to have some sort of galactic alignment, which, I mean, that's all it's supposed to be. It's not supposed to be some cataclysmic event.
So nothing. In other words, nothing's really going to happen. It's just the way they mark up the calendar.
Yeah, pretty much. You know, people just want to be dramatic.
There is one article I read in Scientific magazine that scientists weren't considering the end of a world situation or anything like that. But they are saying, scientists are agreeing that at that particular time, all the planets in the solar system are supposed to be in perfect alignment for the first time. And they can only guesstimate as to what the occurrence is, what it might cause with the gravitational push pull between each one.
That's on the 12th of December, 2012?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it's, you know, 12, 12, 12, I guess. And people, whenever, you know, they see the line numbers line up, they, that sort of back part of your brain that believes in, you know, you shouldn't step on a crack in the sidewalk, and that certain numbers are lucky, certain are unlucky, the one that says, look out for the black cat on Halloween, and the number 13 clicks it and says, oh, 12, 12, 12, we got to be something special about that. Either something really good is going to happen or something really bad is going to happen, but something's got to happen because that's like a pattern. And human beings are pattern-seeking animals. So, but in the gravity from planets in the solar system is just so remote a force in your life. It's even the, you know, gravitational pull of the moon, and it affects the time somewhat. But, you know, this overhead projector thing probably exerts more gravitational force on me than the moon does, given its mass and its proximity to me. So gravitational force is going to be pretty weak, probably not even measurable when you're dealing with the other planets in the solar system. So the fact that they're just all sort of going to line up, it's kind of interesting, but it's not likely to cause. There's no, I don't know of any theory that based in science that would say that would have any significance. The other thing happened back in 1987, where some planets were aligning, called the harmonic convergence. I think it was about that. And the same thing, sort of thing happened. People going up the hills and, you know, expecting like the new age. And of course, for the true believers, a new age was ushered in. For everybody else, it was just another day. And speaking of belief, let's talk about Pascal's wager. So, Pascal...
Did you start recording it again?
I did, yeah. It's actually, I tried the pause button and it didn't pause. You're still going. All right. So, Pascal's wager. That's a lousy time. So Pascal says, first of all, there's no way to prove God's existence. So based on what I hear from a lot of people in the forum, a lot of people would say, right on, Pascal, there's no way to prove God does exist, no way to prove God doesn't exist. So what do? Do you just say, oh, well, I guess I'll have to suspend belief? And Pascal says, no, you should believe in God anyway, even though there's no way to prove he exists. Why? Well, he says... Consider belief in God like a wager. And if you're a gambling woman, you think, okay, well, even though there's no way to tell rationally whether God believes, or whether God exists, when I'm trying to decide whether to believe in God or not, I shouldn't just consider the probability of it being true, but I can consider its value to me as well. So you think about which belief is going to pay off the most. So not which belief is true, but which belief is best for me. And this is known as the pragmatic argument. This is why James talks about it. The pragmatic argument for God's existence. Or I'll say the belief in God. So again, there's no way... No way to prove God exists. I wish I had a better pen. I see none. I made the mistake of cleaning out my satchel there and leaving them on my desk. So, the pragmatic argument for belief in God. So there's no way to prove God exists. Decide whether to believe based on what's best for you. Or better, put it this way, which way pays off? Or which way is likely to pay off the most? Which way is likely to pay off? Say pay off in the end. Overall, over the course of your life. So there's two possibilities. God exists. God doesn't exist. And there's two possible actions you can take. Believe or don't believe. And Pascal says, if you suspend judgment, it's just a special case of not believing. This is I'm reading George A. Smith's book called Atheism, the Case Against God. And he makes this point that if you're an atheist, you're not necessarily someone who denies God's existence. You're just a person who doesn't believe in God. And so when it comes down to it, it's a binary choice. Either believe or don't believe. Now, if you don't believe, you might actively deny God's existence. You might say that you just don't know, in which case you're agnostic. But agnosticism is just a special case of atheism. Or you can believe, where you have some positive belief. You actually do believe God exists. And so, now what Pascal says, what happens when if you believe and God exists? What does he say about that? What's the result? Hit the jackpot. So you get heaven, and he says infinite reward. So it's like past infinity. Eternal life with God in heaven. Good job. Okay, what happens if you don't believe in God and God doesn't exist? Or actually, let's say, what happens if you don't believe that God exists? Let's take this one. So, yeah, you lose your shirt, you go to hell, and it's infinite loss. Okay? Now it gets kind of tricky. What happens if you don't believe and God doesn't exist? Here you break even. No gain. No loss. But then what happens if you believe and God, it turns out God doesn't exist, according to Pascal?
It's okay.
You still win something. So you get finite gain. So you win something. And what do you get if you believe in God, even though he doesn't exist? What good is belief in God if it turns out that it turns out to be false and there isn't one?
You get the consolation of guys for life well lived.
Yeah, so life well lived, hope, even though it's a baseless hope, maybe you have no fear of death, moral courage perhaps to do the right thing.
False sense of security.
Sense of security.
What does that say under finite gain?
Finite gain?
Win something.
Win something?
Don't put a false sense of security.
A finite gain, win something. So you have a sense of security, which turns out to be false. But you don't know that it's false at the time. You don't say, oh, I love having this false sense of pure security of that belief in God gives me. You think, when I die, even though my body dies, my soul goes to be with God in heaven. And I'll be up there, you know, and see my family and my friends and lost loved ones, or the ones that made the right choice here. And we'll be together always. And that gives you a sense of comfort, right? And your Heavenly Father is looking over your shoulder and making sure everything goes all right. It kind of makes you feel good. You don't think, oh, I live in a black and pointless universe. I evolved from the primordial ooze, and I'm here for but a little time, after which my body will decompose and my consciousness will be annihilated. Right, in a cold, dark universe, which cares nothing for me. That's kind of depressing, right? So you think about, or to think, oh, there's a meaning for everything. There's a God, there's a purpose for my life. That there's a God in heaven who designed this all. And even though I might not know what's going on, and I can't figure it out, it's all part of God's plan. It all work out, man. You're like, oh, it makes me feel kind of good. makes me want to get up in the morning. Yeah, I mean, so you say, hello, universe, you know. Hi, God, this is Jeff. What are we going to do today? As opposed to waking up saying, hello, bleak and pointless universe. Will I die today? I don't know. I might be hit by the bus. It could be completely random. Yeah. You're not answering back because you're a dark, pointless universe with no consciousness. So you can see how you might think that even if there isn't a God, even if there isn't any meaning to life, believing there is might actually be good for you. And overall, if you look at the demographic studies of people that believe in God, they tend to be overall happier, have lower stress levels, they tend to be healthier, they tend to live longer. They tend to be better psychologically adjusted. They have better relationships. And just across the board, every measure of human well-being, overall statistically, religious people seem to do better. And who are the people that are really screwed up? Well, like your atheists, right? And atheists are a very small percentage of the population. And this doesn't say that I'm not saying that every atheist is a screwed up person. I'm saying overall, if you look at the general tendencies, atheists have more psychological problems, they have worse relationships, more health problems, tend to die younger, and report being subjectively less happy than people who believe in God, and particularly religious people. And so you can see how Pascal might say, if you're a betting person, if you're just going on the demographic information to sort of maybe hedge your bets, you might say, oh, maybe I should wager on God. Yeah.
What information? Where did you...
So if you look at there's a number of, there's the Pew poll. The Pew has done a lot of demographic studies on belief in God. I think Gallup's done some as well. There's just numerous sociological studies that show that people who have spiritual beliefs, particularly people who are regular churchgoers, they tend to do better in all measures of
life. Religion besides Christianity?
Yeah.
I wonder about that. So just if you have something to believe in.
Yes, you can see how, if you have a particular religious belief, you're probably, you're part of a community, right? You have people looking out for you. You feel like you have a meaning and purpose, or you're less likely, perhaps, to become depressed. This is one of the criticisms of religion is that it's a crutch, right? That it's a psychological crutch. Well, if human beings are metaphorically born with one leg, maybe a crutch is a good idea. I mean, maybe the crutch helps, right? Instead of thinking, oh, I'm just going to hop around on one leg my whole life, maybe you can use the crutch. The funny thing, though, is if you recognize it's a crutch, then it kind of doesn't work because you have to really believe. You can't just sort of say, okay, I'm just sort of going to fake it. Although Pascal thinks that maybe faking it for a little while might actually lead to real belief. And we'll talk about that in a minute, too. Yeah.
Is this implied religion, or is it just God in general?
Well, that's a good question. Pascal seems to think that if you believe in God, you're believing in Christianity. But that's not necessarily the case.
Right, I mean, the Gnostic people and stuff like that, I'm assuming my idea of the Gnostic belief in God, but don't believe in religion, is that correct? Or?
Well, you said, are you saying Gnostic or agnostic? There is a difference.
Okay.
So I'll just briefly. So agnostic. Doesn't know. An agnostic, the word gnostic has the word with the word no. An agnostic is a person who doesn't know. Or like an atheist, again the A in Latin means no. So an atheist, it says no, no theism, no God. Agnostic, no knowledge. No knowledge of whether there is a God or there isn't. And the idea is that this is just a special case of atheism, because an atheism is a person who doesn't believe in God. An agnostic doesn't believe in God. The agnostic says maybe there is a God, maybe there isn't a God, but they don't have a positive belief in God. They sort of suspend a judgment. But, yeah, they're an atheist in the sense that they don't believe in God. Right? Atheism shouldn't be seen as a positive belief or a worldview or a lifestyle or anything.
Should not.
Yeah, should not, right. It's like, if atheism is a religion, then not collecting stamps is a hobby. atheism is not a positive belief. It's the absence of belief. It's just not having a belief in God. And so Pascal, and I think it makes sense philosophically to sort of consider this as a special case of this, of agnosticism as a special case of atheism. And sometimes in the literature you'll see the phrase like agnostic atheism, which is just basically atheists who don't claim to know whether there's a God or not. And then you get all sorts of different kinds of agnostics. Like people will say, well, I don't know and neither can you. Like the dogmatic agnostic atheist. And then you have the people, then you have the agnostics who are sure that they don't know and nobody can know. And then you have the agnostics that say, well, I've never really investigated. I have no idea whether there's a God or not. They're just sort of haven't thought about it, right? Yeah.
So I take issue with one element of this. It's the assumption that if you don't believe in God and it turns out he exists, we could go to hell for it. I don't see why that should be part of the criteria for going to heaven or going to hell.
That's a good question.
I prefer to think that God would enjoy a nice bit of chukka at the faces of the atheist who says he welcomes him into heaven.
Yeah, so what?
Let's put objections here.
So what were you closing on that? So
that would just be like a theist, but you wouldn't be any particular religion. So the question was, what do you call a person who believes in God but not in any particular religion? So you can just call that person a theist, and you can have a Christian theist or a Jewish theist or a Muslim theist. And then you have like variations like polytheism, belief in many gods, monotheism, belief in one God, and then the kind of mystical Eastern beliefs like pantheism that everything's God. It's kind of hard to figure out sometimes. Let me just stick with the Pascal's argument for a second. So going back to like the way he's thinking about things, if Pascal's right in the way he lays out the possibilities, would you ever want to bet against God? What's the best you can do according to Pascal if you bet against God? If you bet that there isn't God? This is the best you can do is break even, right? So if you look at, okay, if I'm going to not believe, what are the two outcomes? And the two outcomes it looks like are, oh, either I lose everything or I break even. Who would take that bet, right? Suppose I were to say, hey, I got a bet for you. I flip a coin, heads I win, tails you lose, right? Would you take that bet? No. If I said, I'm going to flip this coin and I'll give you a wager. So I flip this coin, and if it's heads, then I get everything you own. If it's tails, nothing happens. Right? You wouldn't take that. That would be an irrational bet to take. And what Pascal's argument is that betting against God is the same way. Because if you're wrong, God's going to send you to hell. If you're right, you're not going to win anything at all. So you're always better with the belief choice. Because you're going to win at least something. And so you get like the idea is that if you're right, you win everything, you get the jackpot. If you're wrong, you still win something. And so you're going to come out ahead no matter what you do. No matter which is the case, whether God exists or doesn't, you're still going to come out ahead. Now, a couple of people have mentioned problems with this already. Yeah?
Well, except for that you've wasted your whole life believing in something that wasn't true, if God doesn't.
Well, but think of all the good things.
Yeah, like wars and, slaughtering people and genocide.
And what if you completely miss something that doesn't exist?
And you have to ask, how do you know if you have the right God?
Right.
Well, let's talk about like wars. Is wars really a part? Okay, so you might say religion. So the idea is Pascal downplays the negative aspects.
You say
of religion. So you might say religious wars.
Colonization.
What's that?
Colonization.
Well,
I guess that's all.
South
America, in Mexico, South America.
Yeah, well, there's a question about whether that's driven by religion or whether it's driven by politics.
Was this objection
primarily?
Objection?
So the objection to Pascal. So the idea that Pascal downplays the native aspects of religion, like, you know, religious wars, religiously inspired genocide, like the genocide you see in the Old Testament, the Janjaweed militias in modern day Sudan today, all the stuff going on in the Middle East, right, with the, you know, Taliban cutting off the tips of the fingers of girls that put nail polish on, and executing homosexuals and treating women as second class citizens, and just sort of go down the line. You can find in every religion violation of human rights and atrocity of various kinds done in the name of God. And sometimes, you know, going back to the earliest teachings of the founders of religions, of these religions, you'll find practices which treat people badly, which violate what we think of as basic human rights, and so on. What about the sacrifices necessary for a religious life? I mean, if you're going to live a traditionally religious life, and, you know, pick any of the religions, I suppose, but you might think in particular of the Judeo-Christian tradition. What do you think about, like,
tithing?
Yeah, giving money to the church, giving money to the poor.
What's going on right now?
Yeah, some people would say, well, that's not a sacrifice. That makes you a good person. What about, like, I'm just thinking of the sort of more traditional forms of religion, particularly Catholicism. And if you follow it strictly, you know, you're not going to be able to use birth control and have all these kids take care of. You're never going to be able to enjoy a dirty joke, go out and get drunk with your friends without feeling guilty. Got to show up for church Sunday morning, and you might have to sit there ceremony. That might be kind of boring. It's not. And if you're really going to be like a follower of Jesus, you know, Jesus says, "Take up your cross and follow me," and that you have to sacrifice your own life to be his follower. That he says, you know, get the quote right, but basically he says if you're not willing to give up your life for him, then you're not worthy of him. And so metaphorically, you know, every day you're supposed to pick up your cross, an instrument of torture and death, die to yourself and follow Jesus. Well, that's a pretty big sacrifice, right? That's so, and, you know, if you're just going to be a nominal believer and show up for church, you know, Easter and Christmas, maybe that's not that big of a deal. But Pascal might say, well, you don't really believe in God, and you're just sort of looking for some fire insurance or something, and it's not going to work. Yeah.
So, I mean, that representation of supposedly what Jesus said, I think, is kind of another generalization. I don't believe that, like, Christ himself said, take up your cross and act as I do. I mean, like, he didn't, from my teachings and from my understanding, didn't want people to follow him as they did. He wanted to teach people how to be good people. That was the whole principle of his teachings. Not to, like, idolize him. That's why he destroyed the bull. Because he didn't want to be idolized or to teach idolization of things. You know? And, like, I believe that it's somebody's interpretation that we should put the cross or carry the cross on our backs and be willing to crucify ourselves in memory of him. That's exactly contrary to what he was trying to teach.
Well, you look at the earliest teachings of Jesus in the Gospels, and it's all about self-sacrifice. Here's a quote from the Gospel of Luke, and you can find this in the other Gospels too. Whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross daily and follow me. So that's the... And, you know, the Gospels are the earliest and most authentic teachings of Jesus that we have. And some of the sayings of Jesus go back to the first century. All the Gospels were written before the close of the first century. So this is what we've got as far as the historical Jesus goes. Yeah.
So you're telling me that the cross that he was crucified on was the symbol that he was choosing to idolize?
I mean, using this word idolize, you know, Jesus was a Jew. He would have been against idolatry. he's not telling people to worship a cross, and the earliest Christian symbol was a fish.
But
it's a symbol, though. It's a symbol. Yeah, Jesus is speaking metaphorically. He says, you have to die to yourself every day. Follow me. Be altruistic. Gospel is a gospel of self-sacrifice, denying your wants and needs for a spiritual cause. And he's not literally saying you have to be executed or something, but it's a metaphor. So, but most religions tell you self-sacrifice, particularly Eastern religions, say the ego is bad, desiring wealth and power and fame is bad. If you're watching the Oscars thinking, oh, I'd like to be one of those guys up on the stage getting an Oscar, or you're looking at somebody walking down the red carpet and saying that fancy dress looks great, I'd look great in that, or that you think, oh no, I shouldn't want those things, I should just be content with my lot in life, and I should go off and meditate and focus on spiritual things. And that's the message you pretty much get in the Eastern religions. The ego is bad, desires are bad, and you sort of got to push them down and self-sacrifice and focus on the next world, the spiritual world, and on learning spiritual and moral lessons. And the same thing in Judaism and Christianity. Judaism gives a little lighter on the sort of sin and desire, being bad. Christianity is, there's a lot of asceticism in it. And, it's like, it's okay to enjoy sex, but it has to be within a monogamous, opposite sex marriage, No going out sowing some wild oats, that's wrong. And gambling and drinking and carousing, shouldn't be doing that stuff. So you think about giving up all that stuff, not being able to enjoy a dirty joke, or, a skin flick on late night cable, right? All that stuff, bad, bad, bad. Internet porn, definitely out. Right, so yeah, I mean, for most people, particularly young, people with hormones coursing through their veins, those are insignificant sacrifices. And so to sort of pan those off is like not even mattering. I'm not sure what Pascal wrote this. This reminds me of Saint Augustine, his famous sinner's prayer, which was as follows: "O Lord, give me repentance, but not yet." And so, early on, he had a mistress, and, for about, until he got, into his late 40s, he's pretty much, living as a secular person, and shacked up with this woman who's a bit younger than him. And then after, a time, he decided, oh, I'm going to be chaste and pure, as he's, starting to slow down a little bit.
That was his life.
Anyway, so sacrifice. What about somebody else mentioned another objection here? So this about hell. So it would. This is important. Put it this way: Would God, especially a just and loving God, would? Let me just put this. Would a just and loving God send you to hell? For not believing him? Especially if the evidence is ambiguous.
Given the circumstances, I think he'd just be like, oh, you're a skeptic about my existence? That's perfectly reasonable. Certainly not damn good offense.
I didn't give you any evidence. After all, there's no way to tell. And Pascal says at the offset, there's no way to prove it, right? So, maybe God would pat you on the back saying, good job, you withheld your judgment. You didn't, sort of believe it with blind faith, but you said you wanted to prove to you, and I really didn't give you any reason to think I existed, so what do I expect, right? Instead of you're going to burn, and be tortured forever and ever in a fiery pit. Why? Because you didn't believe something you didn't have any evidence for.
That doesn't sound benevolent to me.
Way in the back.
So if you want to do good things because you want to do good things, and it's the right thing to do, not because you're afraid of going to hell.
Okay, that's another objection. So
it's an attempt to drive people into being
fear. Using fear as a method. to keep people in the loop.
How is this would God reward spiritual gamblers? It seems cynical and selfish to believe in God for pragmatic reasons. But to avoid hell. You're really, I mean, you're motivated by fear. As they use this phrase before, fire insurance.
It's like the book of Job, where he proves that the faith is there regardless of the rewards.
Yeah, the Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Yeah, that's what he says. So even though, you know, God allowed Satan to do all these terrible things to him, Job says, well, hey, if I only worship God when things go my way, I don't really worship God because I should. I'm just doing it because he's given me stuff, which was sort of the accusation of Satan at the beginning of the story. He said, oh, the only reason Job serves you is because you give him all these rewards, God, to take away all these rewards, and he'll curse you. And then there's another bet going on. And God says, okay, Satan, you're on. And then he gives Satan leave to go and just do all these horrible things to poor old Job. And what he did, he doesn't tell Job why it's happening either, right? So, you know, Satan kills off his family and destroys his house, all his cattle and all his worldly possessions. And to add insult to injury, he leaves his wife alive to lecture him. And inflicts him with a horrible case of like boils, so his life is miserable. And then at the end, you know, of course, he doesn't curse God and he stays faithful, and then God rewards him. You know, you think about that too. You know, maybe that kind of God would send you to hell for not believing in that. So I mean, that seemed kind of unfair. To me, I look at the poor story of Job, and Job never finds out why all this stuff happened. And God gives him a long lecture that goes on for like 5 pages about questioning him in the first place. And then, and then rewards him at the end, but never tells him why all this stuff happened. Yeah, did you have any comments?
Would there be a specific belief in God that you have to have not to be exposed? Because there's many different beliefs in God.
Which
so
God?
Which one is right?
Which God? Which religion? And then which interpretation of which religion? Which, I'll just put which sect here. So, you know, if you're like, it's not just if you pick a religion like, okay, Christianity, okay, Catholic or Protestant, Jehovah's Witnesses, Mormons, Christian Science, Baptist, Episcopalian, and actually, I mean, those particular religion, those particular subsects don't have, there's not much a difference between, say, the Episcopalians and your Methodists and Lutherans and so on. But just the question about which big tradition in them, whether Catholic or Protestant, Mormon is sort of different than the rest of them. Jehovah's Witnesses and another really different group. I mean, you'd spend your whole life like studying all these different religions, trying to figure out what they taught and their different beliefs and what has the most, which seems to have the most going for them. Judaism, we go back there. Maybe Islam. What's his name? It could be like Liam Neeson, convert to Islam on a film shoot there. Hinduism or Buddhism. I mean, there's so Taoism. Confucianism, you mix a couple of them together, a little bit of Confucianism, a little bit of Taoism. That's what they tend to do in Asia. People tend to sort of mix and match Buddhism, Taoism, and Confucianism. So that's a good question. And then, so it's not like, oh, I just believe in God and I don't have to worry about God being angry at me and sending me to hell. You got to get the right God, you have to find the right religion, and make sure you have the right beliefs. I think Christopher Hitchens is the one who says everybody's an atheist. Even the believer's an atheist because he doesn't believe in the other guy's gods. He only believes in his own God. So he believes in he believes in the Trinity, but he doesn't believe in like the Bodhisattvas, right? So he's an atheist with regard to other people's gods. He doesn't believe in Krishna. He doesn't believe in Vishnu, and he doesn't believe in Zeus or any of the other gods that ever existed, just his gods. So even though initially it seems a little sort of plausible, and this is one of those things you'll hear, like maybe if you're hanging out with your friends late at night and you sort of talking about religion, and someone says, "Oh, what do you think? Do you believe in God?" And you'll hear people say, "Well, you know, what's the downside? And if I believe in God, that at least I may get something out of it. And I'm really worried if I don't believe in God, God's going to punish me." And so it sort of like seems like a safe bet. People will say things like that, and they're harking back to Pascal's wager. Any other criticisms or arguments against, or maybe arguments for? Now with this, can you choose to believe in God? So can you make yourself believe in God? Is that a choice you can really make? Necessarily? Or can you choose your beliefs generally? Or generally, for that matter. Yeah.
What if God knows that you are only believing in him to not go to hell?
Yeah, so that goes to this sort of this cynical third area. Yeah. Yeah, so God might say, "You're just believing in me because you want to avoid hell." Yeah.
Well, then you believe in him, and then bingo.
So, I mean, how do you know which one's going to satisfy God or appease God's wrath? And that's another problem, is trying to figure out. You have to figure out what God wants. And by doing that, what do you have? You have to, a bunch of old books you have to pour through, and they all tell you different things about who God is and what he wants. And then you're left trying to figure out. That's the next. I'm getting confused whether I want to have that on the docket for this week or next week. I think we're going to try to squeeze that into this week, which is week 8. Oh no, just Kierkegaard. Next week is religious knowledge. So we're doing a little bit of religious knowledge, but mostly more belief in will. And so this is a good question about how much control do you really have over your beliefs. And what Pascal says is, you really, even though if you don't have, or there might be some people that have a hard time believing in God. And so anybody remember what he recommends? What's his solution for, you really want to believe, but you can't believe? You're like the blind, there's a blind beggar, I think, who shouts out to Jesus, "Lord, I believe, help my unbelief." So the idea is that he really wants to believe, and he kind of sort of believes, but he's not really sure because he's got some doubts. Pascal says, what you want to do is behave as if God exists, and sort of condition yourself to believe. So he thinks, and this is a kind of an indirect approach. Indirect control. Yes, he says you only have indirect control over your beliefs, not direct control. So what do you do in order to produce belief in God? He says, well, you know, go to church, read the Bible, pray. And even if you don't really believe it at first, if you do it long enough, it's just going to sort of take. You'll find yourself singing along in church, and finally you'll really believe those things you're singing. Finally, you'll be praying late at night, and finally it'll seem like somebody's really listening. And so you want to do this, you know, over time. Yeah.
But isn't it all in vain, because the initial intent was that, I mean, pretty much it's kind of like, well, I don't like it now, but if I just keep on doing it, I might like it later. You know what I mean? Without the initial intent being that it believes already, you know what I mean? It's kind of forced upon them. It's not, maybe, I don't know if I'm using the word correctly, concept of autonomy?
Yes.
Autonomous?
Right, so you're saying that...
because the initial intent is not to believe. The initial intent is so that... to force yourself to believe so that later not going to hell, or so that later you won't go to hell. You know what I mean?
Right. What you really want to do is avoid going to hell.
Exactly.
Or you want,
to
go to hell. Yeah. And so what you're doing is you're trying to drum up this belief. Like, suppose, think about, like, okay, suppose you're like a sort of conservative Republican, and due to circumstances, you find yourself living in Oregon. And your life's kind of, particularly like in the city of Eugene. And life's kind of hard for conservative Republican living in Eugene. And as you look at the field of Republican candidates for president, you're thinking there's no way in hell any of those guys are going to beat Obama. And when I go down to like the Chamber of Commerce, they're all a bunch of libs. And if I let, like, you know, if I let it slip out that I listen to Rush Limbaugh, nobody's going to want to be my friend. So, you know, I could kind of masquerade as a Democrat, and that would help because I'm in, like, the organic food business, and, I, you know, conservatives are persona non grata. So it's going to, like, it would really help me if I was, like a, if everyone thought I was a liberal, progressive Democrat. On the other hand, if I'm, like, trying to fake it, people are going to know. They'll be able to figure it out. So what I want to really do is, like, look for, I want to really believe all this crazy stuff about, like, you know, oh, you know, green energy boondoggles, and I want to, because that kind of goes along with my business, which is organic vegetables. Now, I look at it rationally now, and I think global warming, there's no evidence for it. I look at green energy leads to disaster in Spain, that crazy cylinder stuff, $500 million down the drain. Objectively, I think it's crazy, but I think subjectively, if I really believed all this crazy stuff, it'd be really good for my business, because what I want to do, I want to stay in business, I want to stay in Oregon, and I want people to be my friends. And so what I would do is I'd start reading, you know, Rachel Carson's Silent Spring. Maybe I'd start, like, you know, I'd start maybe reading Das Kapital. I'd be going down to the Saturday market looking for people with tie-dyed shirts to talk to. I'd go to, like, the Media Matters site and read all the evils of the about the Republicans. I'd, you know, go to the Center for American Progress and talk to people there. And I just, like, do all these things to try to fill my head with all this sort of leftist propaganda. And eventually I'd say, yeah, you know, those Republicans, they suck, and conservatives are taking our country down. And I could, like, convert myself. And then it would be good, because then all my friends would be libs, and they'd buy my organic vegetables, and my business would do well. I'd have lots of friends. My wife would, my wife's relationship with me and my wife, who's like a big lib, would be better, and so on, because we'd have values in common. So would that be okay? What do you think? Would that be a good idea?
No.
What's that? After a while it would be, because I just sort of, like, I just sort of recondition myself. Like, my goal is I want to have these beliefs, and here's all the stuff I'm going to do to sort of, like, brainwash myself into believing all this stuff, which I don't believe right now. And you could do it some other way, right? You could say, oh, you know, I'm a liberal progressive, and I moved to Orange County, and my business is some conservative business, right? So the idea is I'm going to change my beliefs to be all conservative, because I see the writings on the wall, and I'm in Orange County, and it's a bunch of conservative types here, and I want to fit in. And most people would say that would be hypocrisy, that would be compromising your values, or they might say it might not work. So, I mean, that's the idea, that it's kind of an artificial way of trying to drum up belief. So there's one question is, you know, would it work? And Pat, this is one of the objections that James has to this. James says it wouldn't work. And also it's sort of disingenuous or hypocritical and cynical. So it has basically the same problems about the larger weight that we found in the larger wager. Anything else we want to beat up with Pascal on, or anyone want to give away, sort of trying to recast the wager where it seems more plausible, more believable? let's leave the Pascal's wager behind.
Go ahead. I think the only way that it'll work is if you choose to want, like if you choose yourself to want to investigate there being a God, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Instead of just conditioning yourself or like having it forced on you. Like if you actively search and seek that information for yourself and then you come up to in the end, you know, all right, well, I believe in God because of this, instead of, well, that's my options.
But then that's assuming that you can come up with some objective way. But the argument starts out saying there's no way to tell either way. But what you could say is that you all investigate whether or not there's a God, and if the evidence points that way, then I'll believe in God. If it doesn't, then I won't. But then it's not, you're not dealing with the pragmatic, you know, argument anymore. You're not going on what's good for you. You're going on what's true, even though it might not be good for you. You might argue too that. I think this one, which is it? This second one here. I think it's like this idea that is God really going to send you to hell for making the wrong choice? It seems that if God didn't give you enough evidence, this would be, give me an analogy here. Suppose I would say, pop quiz today. You know, everybody take out your piece of paper and I'll say, this is worth your 90% of your course grade. And then I proceed to give you the questions. The first question is on describe Foucault's metaphor of the panopticon. What is a panopticon, and how does it apply to modern politics? Question number two: describe what Hegel means by absolute spirit. And then question number three would be. Explain Jacques Derrida's theory of deconstructionism. Right. Would that be a fair quiz for me to give, given what we've done in this class so far?
No.
It would be fair even if we had been studying that stuff, but that's another story. But so wouldn't it be analogous, though, if God you know, created the world that he did with all these different religions, all over the globe, all with long histories and holy books that say different things, all with the priesthoods that claim the holy books mean different things, and with occasional people that pop up and say, God talked to me and here's what he said. But then the people who talk to God all are getting different messages, right? And then you're supposed to figure out what God wants you to do. That would seem kind of unfair, it seems to me. And suppose if you're like a skeptic, you say, well, I just want some proof, like, that there is a God. And then all you get is, like, people say, well, look at the world. Where did the world come from? You think, I don't know, maybe it's always been here. Mm-hmm. Well, what about the intricate design of the fitting of means to ends? You say, I don't know, if I were God, I would have made so many cockroaches and mosquitoes, and I would have made human teeth so they wouldn't, like, rot. When they came into contact with sugar and make sugar taste really good. And you know, you sort of go down the line, you know, you think, well, it doesn't look like if God designed the world, he must be either sort of incompetent or maybe he's sort of malevolent, that he made the world miserable and uninhabitable except for like basically Santa Barbara and the Riviera. They're the only places with nice climates. Every place else, it's like out today, right? It's like, it's hail and snow over the weekend, and I got this terrible allergy attack from all the pollens. And then the next day, it's freezing cold again, and now the sun's out, and now it's going to pour rain tomorrow. It's like, if I were God, I would just, I'd design like a Mediterranean climate over the whole world, maybe like some desert for some sand railing and some mountains for some skiing or something like that. So you look at, what about some other arguments? And it seems like none of the arguments for God's existence seem really good. So you're left saying, well, I don't know. And then God says, you didn't guess right. you failed all three of the questions, even though you had no study guide, no idea of the curriculum, no idea what you're supposed to be learning or anything. And at the end of your life, God, if you guess right, God lets you to heaven. If you guess wrong, God sends you to a fiery pit to be punished forever and ever. That seems kind of unfair. So it might be that you'd be better off betting against it, that there would be this sort of God. So you can bet in the opposite way. Okay, let's talk about Kierkegaard. So Kirk, so going back to Clifford, so Clifford says it's always wrong for anyone, anywhere, in any way, on a train, in a plane, on a car, you know, I forget what rhymes with cars. I'm trying to go down the Dr. Seuss thing, right? With a cat, on a mat, or whatever. So the it's always wrong to believe anything on insufficient evidence. Then you have James that comes along and says, well, generally that's true. You shouldn't believe things without sufficient evidence. But if you meet these three criteria, if it's something which is a living option, something you really could believe, if it's a forced option, something that you have to make a choice about or you miss out on something, and it's a momentous option, it's something that's really important, going to have a big effect in your life. If it meets all three of those criteria, go ahead and exercise your will to believe, even if you don't have sufficient evidence. And James says belief in God fits all three of those criteria. He says, so he agrees with Pascal and that it's, he thinks it's living. He thinks that everybody can decide to believe in God or not, even though you might sort of have a constraint on what religion would seem plausible to you. He says that it's forced, and that if you suspend belief for your whole life, you miss out on the benefits of the religious life. And then he says it's momentous because, you know, believing God and having meaning and hope and so on is going to have a big effect in your life. And so James would say that belief in God fits there. Kierkegaard, we come along with Kierkegaard, and Kierkegaard says, you know, to hell with the evidence. He is really strongly arguing that belief is something which is subjective and based on the passions, and that using evidence at all to try to figure out these things is a wrong way of doing things. That it should all be based on faith. And he talks about this difference. Kierkegaard is a Dane, so it's a Kierkegaard, and he puts this in terms of a subjective passionate commitment, or in other words, faith, you know, versus, you know, objective, impartial analysis or reason. And he says, when it comes to God, it's got to be this. And that if you try to figure out the evidence for God based on objective, impartial assessment of the evidence, you're never going to believe in God, and you're never going to have a relationship with God. And he used this analogy of a relationship. And so relationships are subjective. And you don't treat your beloved as an object if you have a good relationship, if you have a real relationship. And he also says you give your loved one the benefit of the doubt. So if, you know, just like somebody, some random person comes up and says, hey, your boyfriend or girlfriend's cheating on you, you're like, well, that's kind of weird. Why would this person tell me this? And then maybe if there's some evidence here and there, you don't immediately jump to the conclusion that your loved one is cheating on you or deceiving you. You give them the benefit of the doubt until there's like overwhelming evidence or really good evidence of the contrary. But that sort of idea of giving the person the benefit of the doubt is sort of like faith. And you don't think, you don't wake up in the morning and say, I wonder if my beloved still loves me. Maybe I'll give her a quiz. And you come up to her and say, darling, how many times did you think of me yesterday? Right? What, only 12? You know, I don't know. I'm kind of iffy on whether you still love me or not. What are you going to do to prove your love to me today? Right? You wouldn't do that because you're in a relationship, so you don't treat that person as an object. You're not constantly looking for evidence that they love you. And in the same way, if you treat God like that, if you treat God as an object for analysis, as as something you would sort of, in the same way you treat like a scientific experiment, then you're objectifying God and you can't really have a relationship with Him, according to Kierkegaard. And he says, he makes this argument, he says, consider that the dreams of the theologians have been met. That we look in the Bible, and again, he's talking from the standpoint of Christianity, and all those books in the Bible and no others belong in the Bible. And that in each of those books, there's no contradictions. Everything is logically consistent. And moreover, there's historical evidence that all the authors that say that that the books are attributed to are proved to be those authors. And so we have all these confirmations that Jesus rose from the dead and that Paul wrote all the letters attributed to him, and that all those events in the Old Testament are verified in archaeology, the fall of the walls of Jericho, and so on and so forth. And we have all these proofs. And he says, what would be established then? Is anybody who didn't believe already going to believe? No. Is it going to be any use to the person who already believes? No, because they already believe on the basis of faith. So what use is it? So he says, trying to go to reason to prove God's existence or the truth of Christianity is wrong. And what you should do is you should try to tell both believer and the unbeliever they should have faith, a subjective, passionate commitment to God, and don't worry about trying to prove religion to people. So what do you think about that as a way of looking at belief in God?
Can't you get to know your loved one before you marry him?
Yeah, I suppose I'm thinking about my subjective, passionate commitment made too early in the relationship stage with my ex-wife. And I'm thinking I could have used a little more objective, rational assessment at the beginning there before I sort of leapt into the commitment part. So maybe that's the case with God, too. Maybe what you should do is on the front end, do lots of rational analysis, try to figure out what the right belief is, then you can throw yourself into it.
But isn't he talking about the way it sounds, just kind of blind faith?
Yeah, sort of a leap. He talks about having a leap of faith. Maybe you should look before you leap.
Yeah.
In the case of marriage, try before you buy. it's a big commitment, so you want to make sure you make the right decision. It does seem like this kind of a funny dichotomy, this idea that you should take this blind leap of faith.
I mean, I've had it to do though, by a high spirit.
But you're taught to take a blind leap of faith?
Are you?
What's that?
I mean, isn't that like part of the basis of Christianity, not to require just to believe?
Yeah, it depends on what kind of church you get to, I suppose.
I guess.
If you look at the New Testament, actually, a lot of those guys don't seem to be Kierkegaardian. They're talking about how it isn't just about a bunch of myths. Jesus fulfilled all these prophecies, and he rose from the dead, and there are a bunch of witnesses here that saw him. So they were trying to prove that Jesus was the Messiah, and that Christianity was true, and not just some flash in the pan, movement, or that it was sort of made up stories. They were arguing that Jesus actually rose from the dead, and that was sort of the cornerstone of Christian faith, and that he did miracles and so on and so forth. I suppose you get this in kind of Americanized Christianity, this focus on blind faith, and particularly in more sort of emotion-centered churches. I don't want to cast aspersions on anybody, but the Pentecostal churches tend to focus on having a subjective emotional experience. But you get like your standard sort of evangelical churches, your Baptist churches, they tend to focus more on sort of the objective fact of the resurrection, the fact that the Bible's trustworthy and reliable, and those sorts of things. I mean, they try to make that case. And it's the difference between, going to a Billy Graham crusade, a rally or something like that, or a tent meeting, and what you might get in what's called Christian apologetics, or reading somebody like C.S. Lewis, who gives you all sorts of reasons why you should believe in God. The sort of Christian philosophers. The Society of Christian Philosophers It used to be, I'm not sure if it still is, but it used to be the largest special interest group in the American Philosophical Association. So, I mean, they're a big group, and there are a lot of Christians who are also philosophers who try to give reasons to believe. And you can find a lot of precedent for this in the New Testament. So I'm not sure that Kierkegaard's kind of feed, what they call this fideism, this idea of all faith. It's from Latin, the Latin word fide, which means faith. So fideism, this focus on sort of blind faith, an emphasis on faith is the most important thing. I'm not sure that really is an accurate description of New Testament Christianity. So, I mean, that might be some criticism of Kierkegaard. That you look at Paul, the Apostle Paul, sometimes seen as a replacement for Judas, the de facto leader of the early church after Jesus. And he's on Mars Hill, and he's talking with these philosophers, you know, the Areopagus, Ares Hill, I guess, if you're in the Greek. So it's this hill, it's devoted to the god Ares, god of war. And he gives a philosophical defense of Christianity. And, you know, the philosophers scoff at him, and nobody believes, and they say, well, this is really interesting. Let's hear you talk about this again sometime. But they're not ready to make a commitment. But at least he's trying. He's quoting the pagan poets. He's trying to convince them that Christianity is true. He's not saying, you know, just believe, like a Pentecostal preacher trying to drum up some emotional response in his hearers. Which is sort of seems to be Kierkegaard's argument. What about his argument that if you give a proof that nobody who, that either you're going to get two kinds of people, the skeptics, no amount of evidence is ever going to convince them, and then the believers who don't need any evidence. That seems like a good description of how it works in the real world when you talk about religion.
I told you that's the 12 class of people who are like open-minded but need some kind of substance to back it up.
Yeah, I think there's probably some people in the middle, open-minded people. I read this book.
You may want to believe, but how do you believe in something that you can't see? There's nothing there for you to.
Yeah, so I mean, there. Sure, it seems like there should be. So, and so this might be a criticism of Kierkegaard. One might be, you know, people in the middle. Are neither skeptical, overly skeptical, nor believers, but sort of open-minded. Did you have a question? Oh, sorry. Okay. I saw you put your pen up.
Now, is this objection?
It's supposed to be an objection to Kierkegaard. So Kierkegaard wants to say there's some people that there's only skeptics and believers. Not just believers versus skeptics. And a lot of people, if you say, they say, hey, I hope the Bible is just a bunch of stories and they all turn out to be false. And you can say, oh, well, look, you know, here are the walls of Jericho. And look, they fell out, just as the Bible says. And here's an inscription that talks about King David and so on and so forth. And you can show that all the peoples of the Bible that are talked about, the kings and the historical events, pretty much the way the Bible describes them, all the geography, pretty much the way the Bible describes it. And you're thinking, oh, well, maybe I'll take a second look at this, right? At least you might take some people who are maybe on the skeptic side and move them more towards being open-minded. Or if people say, oh, well, the Bible always contradicts itself, and they point out some things, and you show how it's not really a contradiction, that might change people's mind. And so I think he might overstate this a bit as far as how skeptical people are going to be, or that people sort of fall into one category or the other. And maybe there are people in between that maybe reason can sort of bring them a little part of the way.
I think it goes to how much information is enough information as well. My point is that.
Yeah, how do you know how much proof is enough? What's sufficient evidence? And the other thing is if you say this sort of idea that you have to take a leap of faith, it's similar to the Pascal's wager argument. You know, which direction? Why leap towards God? on that towards Marxism, existentialism, Scientology, or, you know, humanism. Why not leap towards atheism, right? So he's saying you should just take a leap in the dark. Well, if it's really a leap in the dark, it's not based on any evidence whatsoever, why leap towards God? And so that, why leap towards God? So, yeah, go ahead.
Well, I don't understand why it's a leap of faith, because either you have faith or you don't, and you can either leap towards, or you can decide not to, but up until that point, you're either one or the other. I don't see, like, how people would wake up one day and be like, all of a sudden they have faith. It seems like it would be kind of a process, like, you know. And then, you've gone through steps, and then you come to a certain point.
Well, you might sort of be in between, like, so there might be in between, like, maybe, like, I know this one professor, Syracuse, and he said, you know, one day I was standing there in church, you know, and singing the hymn, and all of a sudden I was like, you know, I don't really believe any of this stuff anymore. And I was like, and then he just stopped going to church, and now he's an atheist. But he said at that point, he just remembered, like, going to church and singing the hymn, thinking, I don't believe any of this nonsense.
So then he didn't have faith. I don't understand how there could be fence walkers, because even if you're open, and you either still have it or you don't.
I don't know. Another guy I knew in graduate school, he would tell me, some days I wake up and I think, there's got to be a God. There must be a God. This all can't be for nothing. And then he said, other days I wake up and I think, no, there can't be a God. This doesn't make any sense. And he'd like go back and forth. And so I think there are people like that that sort of aren't really sure.
Oh, sure,
50-50. Michael.
Well, you know, like for me personally, like, for the longest time, I was total atheist. I grew up like with a pagan background, you know, a Christian background, and I felt that such conflict with both these beliefs that I went to an atheist want to do. And then one day I was hitchhiking, and I asked whatever being is out there to give me a ride. Literally, as soon as I put my thumb up, I got a ride. So that instilled this faith in me that there's something out there beyond me.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but what is there?
But this is just an example of there being this factor that can sway one's mind into belief or knowing of belief. You know, it's all about personal sense of what you want in your life. Do you want to believe that there's something, or do you want to deny that there's something?
But then it seems like you're just, instead of trying to figure out what's true, if you're just trying to believe something you find pleasant to believe in and drumming up reasons to believe it, you're back to this sort of trying to brainwash yourself.
Isn't that a leap of faith, though? You don't really know. You have no evidence in it. Like, to me, I feel like a leap of faith. Faith is kind of like something that you follow blindly. There's no reason behind it, and you choose to live your life that way. You know what I mean? You'll believe whatever is presented in front of you. Isn't that what faith essentially is?
Well, there's a question about what faith is. Kierkegaard's version of faith is a sort of subjective, passionate commitment, you could say.
Right, but
which is subjective, so it's not objective, it's not based on evidence.
Right.
Yeah.
So since it's not based on evidence, you'll just believe anything?
Well, it's a good question. Like, why believe Christianity? Why not believe in Buddhism? Why not believe in Marxism? Why not have faith in yourself? Why not have faith in L. Ron Hubbard? Or, you know, so you just like... there's this question about what you should have faith in is something that isn't answered. In one respect, I think Pascal hits on something important in that there's always this tension between having a commitment to something, whether it's a cause or a moral belief or an ideal, and having objective evidence for it. Because to the extent that you're trying to get evidence for something, you've got to be impartial, and you're looking at it from an objective standpoint. But to the extent that you're really acting on the belief and involved in it, incorporated into your life, then you're going to be subjective about it, and you're not going to be objective. And so there's this sort of dance between, if you had a let's see attitude towards everything, you could never do anything, right? You wouldn't be able to vote. You wouldn't be able to go out to protest. You wouldn't be able to write your congressman. Because you think, okay, well, this is what I believe now, but am I completely sure? Maybe I'll do some research on the internet for another 5 hours. So, I mean, you'd never be able to act on it. So at some point, you say, I have enough evidence, and now I'm going to, you know, put myself in passionate commitment mode. This seems to be what's true, and I'm going to go with this. But again, you want to reassess it and make sure, you know, every once in a while, make sure your beliefs are in touch with reality, even though you've sort of subjectively appropriated them into your life. So there is a sort of tension between passionate commitment to a belief that you're actually acting on in your life and wanting to be objective and partial and have views which represent reality. And I think Kierkegaard hits on that. His problem, though, is that he sees it as an all or nothing thing, that either you go with evidence or you go with the subjective commitment. And that seems wrong, at least to me. So... So I think that's all we have time for today. So we're going to start on Wednesday. What we're going to be talking about? How much control do you have over your beliefs on Wednesday?